speaker this term, Eduard Barnata from University of Toronto, and I forgot the title, unfortunately.
Okay, I will show it in a minute, that's fine.
Okay.
So, my talk will follow a handout, and I hope you all hold a copy. I don't, because I left all of them over there. And here it is. Oh, now I hold a handout. Good. So now I know my title. A polytime, not polynomial, via solvable approximation, and I'm very, very happy about it. So happy that I've actually invited myself to give this talk, right? I wasn't invited. I've asked Pavel to invite me. So, Pavel, thanks for accepting my invitation. Okay. Also, my talk has a URL, and you're welcome to go there, and eventually there will be a video, and a handout is there. And by the way, this is sort of my general policy. If something is worth saying, it's also worth preserving. So, practically everything I talk is on video, and you should do it too, Pavel, so that I can watch your talks later on. Anyway, this is all, in some sense, work in progress, and it's all fluid and still changing, and help is needed. But maybe I'll start with a tour of what I'm going to talk about. So I'm going to tell you about a certain polynomial time computable, not polynomial, which makes it sort of the only invariant that is computable for very, very, very large knots since the Alexander polynomial in 1928. Here are log-log plots of crossing number versus computation time. If you take log on both sides on a polynomial, you get a linear function. So, this is roughly linear here. This invariant has the best chance of anything else I've ever heard of being able to resolve some conjectures in topology. So I'll come back to it later in my talk.
Actually, prove that certain invariants cannot be computed in polynomial time.
Yes and no. Practically nothing is proven about non-polynomial time in the sense that, people can reduce the computation, or people can show that certain knot invariants are so-called NP-complete, and then it's a wide open problem whether NP-complete is polynomial. Okay, so strictly speaking, nothing was ever proven to be non-polynomial time, but it's very, very strongly expected that practically nothing is polynomial time except the Alexander polynomial and this nonsense. So I'm still going through a tour, through the tour of the highlights of the talk. So the key point, or the most interesting thing from a representation theory, from a Lie algebra perspective, will be that I will be telling you about a certain Lie algebra, G1, which generalizes and of course exists for any semi-simple Lie algebra, but this is the SL2 case, and you can think of it in two ways. In one sense, it's some sort of a solvable approximation of SL2. It's obviously not SL2 because SL2 is not solvable, but it's a solvable approximation of SL2. And in another sense, you can think of it as starting very, very far. Valerio, you should have to take a handout from over there. You have to think of it as if you're starting very, very, very far from SL2, and then you're adding a smidgen of SL2 to it. So like adding a smidgen of salt to a salad. So you start far and deform towards SL2, which is completely different than what people do in quantum algebra, where they start with SL2 and deform away from it. So it's kind of a nice, lovely thing. There is also an unfortunate part, and this is that everything depends, or crucially depends, on knowing a certain polynomial, which is clearly very simple and very memorable. And since it holds all the keys to all the structure, we call it the logos, which is Greek for a principle of order and knowledge. Okay? No, I'm kidding. It's messy. Okay.
And finally, the good news is everything is can be easily turned into computer programs, and this is the whole computer program that computes everything. So it's actually pretty simple. I mean, okay, maybe it's not simple, but at least it's pretty short. Okay? So at the end, it can't be too complicated. And now I can start.
So what I'm going to tell you about, so that was the highlights tour, and now the actual talk begins.
So I'm going to tell you about a certain spectacular knot polynomial, in my opinion, which in fact was discovered by Lev Rozansky maybe 15 years ago or so, and computed to some extent by Andrea Overbay maybe 5 years ago or so. And they managed to not do the publicity that the thing should have deserved. Maybe they haven't noticed that they're actually at the gate of a gold mine. But in fact, it's very hard to find their work, and particularly it's very, very hard to find Overbay's work. So my goal is to reach their targets once again, but from a different direction. And then also tell you why it is spectacular. So very briefly, what did they do? And again, this is going to be very brief. I'm not really going to tell you what they did. I'm going to tell you about what we do. So very briefly, they look at the colored Jones polynomial. The Jones polynomial depends on a parameter Q, which can be regarded as e to the x, where x is some infinitesimal parameter, or small parameter. And it also depends on a dimension of a representation of SL2. So it depends on two variables. If you expand it as a power series in these two variables, you get an infinite array of coefficients. So basically, you get a whole quadrant of coefficients right here. And there is an older theorem that says that in this quadrant of coefficients, all the coefficients below the diagonal vanish. The coefficients on the diagonal, so that's a single variable power series, is in fact the inverse of the so-called Alexander polynomial. And then if you look at the diagonal above it, you start seeing new stuff. But If you want to compute this new stuff from the Jones polynomial, in principle it's computable from the Kohler-Jones polynomial, except that the Kohler-Jones polynomial is extremely difficult to compute in practice. So that's completely the wrong way to view this new stuff. Anyway, they computed it by other means and wrote a theorem about what it looks like, but that's not what I want to talk about. Anyway, so why do I think that this is spectacular? So I want to spend some time telling you why I think this invariant is spectacular. So the foremost reason is on the board right now. And basically, you know, if you have a polynomial time computable invariant, it means that you can compute it for not, in principle, with hundreds, maybe thousands of crossings. And it's a completely new domain. I mean, compare it with what people do lots of time in knot theories these days, which is proving that one incomputable invariant is equal to another incomputable invariant. So certain limit as n goes to infinity of an invariant, which is not really computable, is equal to some characteristic polynomial of some algebraic variety which is in itself not computable, things like that. Or alternatively, people spend a lot of time categorifying invariants that they anyway can't compute. So this is clearly spectacular. I mean, being able to actually compute things. There is actually more, and I want to spend a little more time about the more. So there are certain topological things that this invariant either already says or will likely say in the future. So, or potentially will say something about in the future. So one of them is the genus of a knot, and the other one is the ribbon equal slice conjecture. So first of all, the genus of the knot, so there is a famous statement that every knot can be presented as the boundary of a surface embedded in R3. And then the genus of a knot is the minimal genus of such a surface. Okay? And it's easy to find lower bounds for the genus, namely, you produce a surface. Okay? But it's hard to find upper bounds for the genus of a knot. And one
the
upper...
The other way, yes?
What?
If you produce a surface, it's upper.
Wait, did I get it wrong? If you produce a surface, it's an upper bound, of course, sorry. And it's hard to find lower bounds.
Okay.
Sorry, I messed up. So, there is a way to find a lower bound using the Alexander polynomial. Basically, the degree of the Alexander polynomial is lower bound for the genus of the knot. But it's not always strict. And as I will tell you later, this invariant is certainly going to give a genus bound, and we know why, even though we don't yet have a proof. And this genus bound is sometimes better than the bound you get from the Alexander polynomial. And then there is something even harder, or more complicated, which is this invariant may disprove the ribbon equals slice conjecture. And this takes a little time to explain, so let me start. So first of all, the reason why this invariant has something to say both about genus and about ribbon equals slice is the fact that it extends to tangles. So I want to say a few words about tangles. So a tangle is a piece of a knot drawn in a piece of a plane. So here is a tangle. Here, this piece of the plane is rectangular, but it doesn't have to be. Okay? So it's a piece of a knot drawn in a piece of a plane, and I will restrict my attention to tangles that have no closed components, so all components begin from the boundary and end at the boundary. And furthermore, I want all components to be labeled. So here, this is component number one, where is component number two? This is component number two, and so on. Okay? Now, there are two operations you can perform, or at least two operations you can perform on tangles. One is given two tangles, T1 and T2, you can look at their disjoint union, and it is defined provided the labels are there is no clashes between the labels. So the set of labels of this one is disjoint from the set of labels of this one, and then the operation is to just put these two tangles side by side. Okay? So that's one operation. And the second operation is a little bit more exciting, and it's called the stitching, a stitching operation. So if you have a tangle T, and it has one component labeled A, and another component labeled B, and I'm only drawing the sort of what happens when they exit the tangle. Inside T, sort of where the lines are dashed, they could be completely tangled. They could be knotted with each other. Okay?
So that means that something can stick out. It's not necessarily...
Yeah, so it's a piece of a knot in a piece of a plane, of the okay. Plane. So something can stick out. Like here. So a tangle is a knotted thing with sort of parts pointing out. Okay? I don't know, am I allowed to tell horrible jokes?
Yes.
It's horrible and childish. It's comparable to why is 6 afraid of 7.
Yeah.
but still you are alone.
Okay, so what's worse than a worm in your apple? You know this.
Yes.
Good. So it's of course related to tangles.
Yeah.
Good. Anyway, so back to our topic. So if we have a tangle with component A sticking out and component B sticking out, the stitching operation is to connect the head of A to the tail of B, and now you get a new result, a new component which starts here and ends here, and the tangle is actually a little bit bigger. And you need the name for the new component, so we call it C. Okay? So this is the stitching A and B together operation, calling the result C. Okay? Now, you can complain that this operation is well defined only when the head of tail is near, sorry, when the head of A is near the tail of B. And you would be right, because otherwise it's not clear how to connect the head to the which way to go from here to here. Okay? And the answer is, well, either you extend tangle theory a little bit to what is called virtual tangle theory, so this is the V here, or if you don't know what it is, it doesn't matter. Just think that you restrict your attention to the case where the head of A is near the tail of B. So just ignore this technical difficulty. Okay, it can be resolved either way.
By the way, the piece of the plane is not supposed to be connected.
It sort of doesn't matter the moment you talk about virtual tangles. But if you want to think about everything as being connected, it's all right.
But then when you do this disjoint union, you say...
Yeah, so the same difficulty arises here. And again, either to make this joint union well-defined, you have to decide actually in which way to carry these things out, or you switch to the realm of virtual tangles where it doesn't matter anymore. Okay?
So what is the virtual tangle?
What?
What is the virtual tangle?
It doesn't matter. I don't want to... It just doesn't matter because it's not going to affect anything later on. Okay? But I do want to state... You know what? I will answer in a minute. Okay? I do want to state... a few things about these operations before I go on. So first of all, this stitching operation is a little bit like a product in that it is sort of associative, namely it is meta-associative. However, it's definitely not a product law because it's actually a unary operation. It takes a single input and produces a single output. So it's definitely not associative, but it carries some sort of associativity. So let me just describe to you what is this associativity. So suppose you have a tangle with three components in it. So A, and then B, and then C. And then there are two ways you can stitch the three together. You can either stitch A to B first, and then B to C, or you can stitch B to C, and then A to B. And then A to the result. And you clearly get the same thing, and this is the analog of associativity. And in formulas, it's if you stitch A and B calling the result X, and then follow it with stitching X to C calling the result Y, then that's the same as stitching B to C calling the result X, and then stitching A to X and calling the result Y. So overall, you get A stitched to B stitched to C with the result called Y. That's one property. And then there are a few other kind of silly properties that these operations satisfy, which this is the most interesting one. So the lesser ones have to do with, disjoint union really is associative, a few other things. Okay? And the second point is that tangles are generated using these two operations. The set of all tangles is generated by just an overcrossing and an undercrossing. Why? It's completely obvious. You wanted to get a completely complicated tangle. You take a number of overcrossing and undercrossings, you put them in the plane, whichever, you use the disjoint union operation to put them in the plane, and then you use the stitching operations to stitch them in some way, and clearly you can get whatever you want. Okay? So the handout doesn't say it.
But in principle, it could happen that you cannot draw lines such that it doesn't intersect other lines.
Exactly. You're right. So in fact, if you want to know what is a virtual tangle, a virtual tangle is so you look at the an abstract algebraic structure in which there is a stitching operation and a disjoint union operation which satisfy those axioms that I partially listed. And you look at the free such algebraic structure generated by these two generators, and you mod out by the relations that these two generators satisfy in ordinary knot theory, namely the three Rademeister moves. So basically a virtual tangle is precisely the structure generated by these. But again, it's truly unimportant for what I will say. I mean, if you can always restrict your attention to let's do the operations when they are allowed. Okay, and nothing breaks. You lose nothing by doing this.
And why is it called virtual?
You're pushing me far from where I want to go. Why is it called virtual? Because maybe it's a misname. Maybe the correct name should have been algebraic tangle theory, because it's basically you take the algebraic structure that tangles have, the algebraic operations that tangles have, and you drop the topology, namely you drop the planarity requirement. So you could equally well call it algebraic tangle theory. Okay. But again, you don't lose anything by restricting your attention to those operations you can actually perform. Okay, good. Good. So now, I think I want to skip the discussion of genus. I'll only say that within this structure, or slightly extended, but roughly within this structure, you can describe genus knots of genus G algebraically, and therefore if you have an invariant which is compatible with this structure, it could possibly say something about the genus. But instead of saying this in detail, I want to tell you a little bit more in more detail about ribbon knots. Okay, so ribbon knots are a topological notion. So these are knots that can be presented as the boundary of a disk. So the knot here is red, and the disk, or at least pieces of it, are shown as a blue membrane. So knots that can be presented as the boundary of a disk immersed into R3. It is allowed to have a certain type of singularities, but it is not allowed to have a certain other type of singularities. So the singularities that are allowed are so-called ribbon singularities, which locally look like this. So two pieces of the disk locally look like bands that cross through each other in this manner. Okay? And what is not allowed is so-called clasp singularities, which mean that you have two pieces of the disk that intersect in the manner shown here. So one is coming from one side, the other is coming from the other side, and there is a line of intersections over here. So, example, here is a ribbon knot. So, well, the knot is in red. If you follow the blue membrane, it's kind of clear that it's a disc, right? It looks like sort of a two tennis rackets. Well, here is one racket, and then there is a band, and then here's another racket on the other side. And there are two lines of singularities, but they are of the allowed form. So one can show that not every knot is a ribbon knot. And it's generally hard to tell whether a knot is ribbon or not. Okay? In particular, there is another notion. So the other notion is a slice knot. A slice knot is a knot that can be embedded, sorry, is a knot in S3. So S3 is the same as R3 for the perspective of knot theory. So it's a knot that can be drawn on an S3, which is in itself the boundary of a four-dimensional ball, B4. And then a knot is called slice if it can be presented as the boundary of a disk in B4, which is non-singular, okay? Now, clearly, every ribbon knot is slice. Why? Because, well, if you have this blue membrane, what you can do is you can push blue a little bit down into the four-dimensional ball, right? So you push the membrane a little bit inside the four ball, where the amount of push is proportional to the distance from the edge. And then this singularity disappears because you can push the inside, because you can push this sort of this side deeper than you're pushing that side. However, you can check that this singularity doesn't disappear. So anyway, every ribbon knot is a slice knot, and there is an old time open question whether slice is equivalent to ribbon. The current conjecture, and there are proposed counterexamples, is that some slice knots are in fact not ribbon. And, well, how would you tell that? So, again, if you have a slice knot, you show that it is sliced by explicitly exhibiting a disk in B4 whose boundary is this knot. And then the problem is to show when is knot not a ribbon. There is mostly one useful theorem to show it, and it's the Fox-Milner theorem. And the Fox-Milner theorem says that the Alexander polynomial, whatever it is, of a ribbon knot is always, so it's generally speaking, it's a Laurent polynomial in a variable t, and it can always be presented in the form f of t times f of 1 over t. And then, so if you have a knot whose Alexander polynomial is not of that form, then you know it's not ribbon. Unfortunately, this form is also true for slice knots. So we're looking for other invariants for which we would be able to say that they're, I don't know, so that the invariant on a ribbon knot would have some special form, and we want a proof of that that would be we want to be able to demonstrate it in a way that would be independent from being slice. Okay. So to do that, here is an alternative or a characterization of slice knots. So theorem, or even before the theorem, given a tangle T on two n components, here are two operations that I can perform on it. So one is the tau closure of this tangle, and it is defined as a certain composition of stitching operations as before. Namely, you stitch the tops as shown here. The other operation is the kappa closure. So tau because the result is still a tangle, and kappa because the result is a knot, a knot. So the kappa closure is you stitch the bottoms as shown here, and in the top, at the top, you stitch with a shift of one. Okay? So theorem, a knot is a ribbon knot if and only if there is a tangle in of two n components whose closure is that, whose kappa closure is that knot, and whose tau closure is the r knot. Now, or said differently, the set of ribbon knots is the kappa projection of tau inverse of one, of the r knot. Now, suppose you had an invariant which is well behaved under stitching operations, and I've only used stitching operations here, then it would also be well behaved under tau and kappa. Meaning, so suppose the invariant takes n component tangles to some algebraic space An. When I say algebraic space, I mean something where you can tell if two things are different or not. Something where computable, space of polynomial, a space of matrices, something like that. Okay? Then it would take tangles with 2n components to A2n, it would take knots in tau 1 to something in A1, and it would form a commutative diagram where if the invariant is called Z, then basically doing operations here and then computing the Z is the same as computing Z and then doing the operations here. If you have such an invariant, then it would map ribbon knots to the subspace defined here on the right. So to the kappa projection of tau inverse of the invariant of the unknot, of the untangle. Okay? Now, this is an algebraically defined set, and if you are lucky, it is not the full set. And so you got an algebraic criteria for being non-ribbon. Namely, if you compute the invariant and it comes out outside of this set, you know the knot is not ribbon. Okay. So for this strategy to work, you need two things. Well, you need an invariant, but you also need two things. First of all, the smallest proposed counterexample for slice equals ribbon is written here. It's a pretty big knot. So you need an invariant which is actually computable, so faster is better. And the second thing is a bit more intricate, but basically, the faster, so you can expect the space An to grow in size as a function of n. So the invariant of tangles with n components should be in bigger and bigger spaces. The faster An grows, just by computing dimensions, the lower the chance is that R will not be the full set. So you want a lean invariant. You want an invariant that grows relatively slowly, whose target space grows relatively slowly as a function of n. And if you look at invariants coming from quantum groups, then they all extend to tangles, but generally speaking, these spaces are spaces of tensor powers of certain representations, and these grow exponentially. So you have very little chance that things will work. Okay? Okay.
you know, just to show that I'm serious, the invariant I'm about to tell you about is in fact computable, and here is its value on this specific knot. Okay? Okay. Now, if I had more time, and if I felt you had more patience, I would tell you what's the gold standard. So I would tell you that there is a certain... Yes?
What's the A? The A plus is the Alexander?
The A is the Alexander polynomial, yes.
Okay. And this row is the new one?
And row one is the new one, yes. So again, if I had more time, and if I thought you'd have patience, I would tell you that there is already a pretty good system of such invariants that extends to n tangles, to tangles with n components, and here are all the relevant formulas. It's the so-called gamma calculus for the Alexander invariant. It is the most efficient way to compute the Alexander polynomial, and in fact, Nathan Dunfield has written an efficient program to do it and had run it for knots with up to 1,000 crossings. But unfortunately, well, in some sense, this is all classical information. It's not going to do anything about ribbon equals slice, and it's in some sense known since the 1920s. So my hope is to do something similar. Also, if I had more time, I would tell you why Pavel's picture is appearing on this box. Very roughly speaking, significant parts of Pavel's work with Kashdan can be interpreted as constructing a certain so-called universal or universal invariant or a homomorphic expansion for precisely the type of tangles that I care about. His invariant, well, I mean, it's not really his, but the invariant inspired by his work with Kashdan takes values in a certain space of diagrams. It has all the relevant operations. It's compatible with the stitching operations, etc. Except its target space is extremely exponential in size. So it's not very computable and it's not very useful for my purposes. However, its target space is very, very rich, and therefore it has many interesting quotients. And some of these quotients are lead to what I will be talking about. So again, no details here, but it's just to explain why Pavel is on this slide. Okay? Okay, so this is the end of the propaganda section. And I think I completely failed. Namely, I don't think I did well for propaganda. But hopefully I will do better for the actual construction. Okay? So now I'm starting the construction of an invariant. Okay? So first of all, here is a general property, or a general fact. One way to construct tangle invariants, and it's a very general way, is to start with a unital algebra A. So unital means has a unit. Typically, it will be very infinite dimensional, or just infinite dimensional without the very. And it's even better if it's a Hopf algebra, even though it's not necessary for what I'm about to describe. And typically, it will be the universal enveloping algebra of some Lie algebra, or a completion of such, or somehow close to that. Okay?
So this legitimizes reimbursement of your local expenses, because this seminar is called Infinite Dimensional Algebra.
Oh, good. Oh, so now I can move on and talk back about topology, because now I have no need to. All right, and now I can quit, in fact. Even better, I can go home. Okay. So I need such a unital algebra, but even more,
I need an orange, only for the color coding that comes later, element R inside A tensor A, and I also need gray elements which I will de-emphasize. They're necessary, but I will not say much about them. Hence, they're shown in gray, which you can barely read, and they're called QAPs, because QAP stands for caps and caps. Okay, so caps and caps, or whatever, so QAPs. Okay? Given such information, provided R satisfies some equations, the Young-Baxter equations, you get an invariant of S component tangles, tangles with components labeled by some finite set S, and with values in A raised to the S tensor power. How? Yes?
Can you just say a little bit about what the... So I understand the R is like an R matrix.
Yeah.
Can you even say words? What are these elements, these gray elements?
Oh, they correspond to what you put on the caps, on the caps and the cap. If you have a knot, so a knot is one way to view knots is, you know, they have crossings, but they also have caps and caps, tops.
And you
have to put stuff on the caps and the caps, and the caps and the caps have to satisfy some equations. For example, the windshield wiper relation. So, if you have a cap and the wiper is pointing this way, then it's the same as if it's going pointing this way. So somehow there is some relation between the cap and the crossing, like you can move them across each other in a certain way. There is a short list of relations that you have to satisfy, but I think they're the less interesting relation. The more interesting relations are the relations satisfied by R, and these are the so-called Rademeister relations. So basically, this has to be equal to that. Okay? So it's best not to think about the QAPs until you really have to compute something. Okay? Which actually means, in practice, you have no idea how much time I spend thinking about QAPs. it's exactly because you don't want to think about them. You have to think about them much more than on the... Okay, anyway. How do you get such an invariant? So, suppose you have a tangle. Here is a tangle here in black. Let's call it T0. It has two components. Component X goes straight up, and component Y goes and does something funny. Okay? So, what you do is you put a copy of the R matrix on near each crossing. So basically, so the R matrix is in A tensor A, so you put one of the A's on the over strand, and the other A on the under strand, and you have to be careful about conventions, which one is over, which one is under, what to do if it's a positive crossing, what to do if it's a negative crossing, but again, that's not what I want to spend time on. And so now you have, it's basically as if you've sprinkled algebra elements on those strands. So you sprinkle according to the R recipe. So you put an orange reservoir of algebra elements near, on the over strand here and on the under strand here, on the over strand here and on the under strand here, and so on. And then you multiply the elements that you see along the strands in order. Said differently, if you wish, I could label the sites on which things are sprinkled in order. So on the X component, I see site number 1 and then site number 2.
On the Y component, I see sites 3, 4, and then 5, and then 6, and I've skipped the two quaps. Okay? And then I could kind of unwrap all of this, and on the X component, I see site 1 and 2. On the Y component, I see sites 3, 4, 5, and 6. And the prescription said that I sprinkle the elements in A as follows. So I sprinkle a copy of R on 3 and 6. So this is the 3, 6 copy. I sprinkle another copy on 5 and 1. So this is the 5, 1 copy, and so on. Okay? The result of this is a big combination of elements in the algebra. So if my algebra was generated by elements C, U, W, and B, say, then, and I denote them with red, green, and blue, and black dots, then I'll have some big sum of sort of colored beads on my strands. The problem is, so first of all, the good news is in order to compute such an invariant, all I need to know is the value of R, and I need to know how to multiply in the algebra. Okay? The problem is, how do I extract information out of it? This is happening inside some sort of, this space of beads is very, of beads on strands is in principle infinite dimensional, because I can have arbitrarily many beads, I could use arbitrarily many generators. There might be relations between the generators, and the question is, how do I extract information out of it? Okay? The textbook solution is to use representation theory, and what you do is you find some finite dimensional representation of the algebra, and you represent every bead. And then all you have is a product of matrices along each strand. So overall, you get a tensor in some tensor product of representations. That's in principle finite dimensional, and you've extracted some useful information, some information that can be computed. The only problem with this is the problem I mentioned in the beginning, or earlier on. The tensor product of a number of representations has dimensions which grow exponentially, and so you're not going to get something that's easily computable. Okay? So the textbook solution is useless for my perspective, for our perspective, and therefore, it seems that I'm losing my paycheck, because what I want to talk to you is not about representation theory. Pavel, am I losing my paycheck?
No.
Okay. Thanks. Anyway, so today's solution is different. So what I'm going to tell you is that. And this is, I should have said it right at the beginning, all of this is joined with Roland van der Veen, whose picture is here. And for some specific algebras, what we're going to do is to describe a certain space of formulas of some restricted kinds for elements in U of G tensor to the S. So these are formulas, we will call these formulas ordered perturbed Gaussian formulas. Okay? And the point is that the space of such formulas is relatively small, so it's a relatively it's a space of a relatively small dimension, and yet the stitching operations, so the multiplication operations, we know how to stitch such formulas in a way that will be compatible with these multiplication operations. And hence, we can do all our computations which within this restricted space of formulas, which is small, and therefore everything is relatively efficient. So that's the main point. But first I have to tell you what are the algebras in which we work. So I want to mostly tell you about two algebras. So one algebra is the one-smidgen SL2, and I already mentioned to you why it is, why we like to call it one-smidgen SL2, and it's this algebra G1, which is actually four-dimensional and generated by generators B, C, U, and W, and it's a Lie algebra over the ring of, Q adjoined epsilon, but with epsilon squared equal to zero. So it's really over Q, it's an eight-dimensional Lie algebra, because, right, because the ring is generated by one and epsilon as a vector space. Now, in this algebra, B is central, and you have the following additional commutation relations, which make it a little bit like SL2. So, basically, you should think of C and B as being a little bit like the Cartan element of SL2, the H of SL2, and you should think of U and W as being E and F. So the commutator of the Cartan with W is W, the commutator of the Cartan with U is minus, sorry, it's the opposite order of commutator, so it's negative U, so it's a little bit like SL2, but the commutator of the U of the E and the F, instead of just being the Cartan, it's some funny combination. Okay? So it's a little bit like SL2, but, well, somewhat different. I'll say a word about how it's related to SL2 in a few minutes. Now,
So it represents the generation of SL2 into Heisenberg, basically.
Yes. Okay. Yes. It's somehow, or if you wish, it's a, you start from Heisenberg and you perturb it in the direction of SL2. Okay? So this is what we learned from, one thing that we learned from Ettinghoff and Kasdan, is that if you have a solution of the classical Young-Baxter equation, you automatically get the solution of the Young-Baxter equation, so you get a knot invariant, or a beginning of a knot invariant, at least. So you can check, and it's very easy, to check that the element Rij, written here, is a solution of the classical Young-Baxter equation in the universal enveloping algebra of this Lie algebra. So there is a chance that we will find a knot invariant. And one final point, or two final points, well, if you think of this algebra over Q, where it is then an eight-dimensional algebra, then it is solvable. Because, well, here is a tower of subalgebras so that the quotients of each one with the next is abelian. And the fact that it's solvable means that you can actually compute in it. Okay? So, and maybe the last comment is, if you're worried about the infinite sums that I'm going to write later, then there is a way to grade everything, and the degrees are written here. And everything that I'm, whenever I'm writing a completion, it's a graded completion with respect to these degrees. And again, I will not say anything more about it, but everything makes sense in this context.
Are you planning to make a break?
I suppose so. Yeah, so let's, should I, when is the normal time for a break?
Yeah,
well, about now, but it's good to have a logical point of, when you finish some topic.
Okay, let's call it a break now. Okay.
So for 10 minutes.
10 minutes.
Okay.
So for 10 minutes. Good.